BBC News.
And the news was read by Neil Sleat.
On BBC Radio 4.
It helped my passion for introducing a wider audience to the arts.
Reliving the early days of Strictly Come Dancing.
People realised that opera singers and classical artists could be good fun.
Including the soprano Leslie Garrett and the news presenter Natasha Kaplinsky.
In that first series, we were all learning what a foxtrot was. We were learning what a cha-cha was.
Plus Anton Dubec and Craig Revel-Horwood.
It's just been extraordinary and changed my life forever.
The reunion, Strictly Come Dancing, with me, Kirsty Warg. Next Thursday morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And now on Radio 4, the award-winning comedian Sarah Kendall returns with the final instalment of her acclaimed storytelling show, Sarah Kendall Australian Trilogy. This part is entitled 75 Years.
Hello. Hi, I'm Sarah. Welcome to the show. Now, I've been thinking a lot about luck lately, good luck and bad luck, and how can you ever really tell the difference? And in the summer of 1988, when I was 12 years old, I had to choose which grandmother I was going to go and stay with for 3 weeks. My parents were going away to work on their marriage again! And I had one grandmother called Shirley. Grandma Shirley was fun. I mean, she was a little dangerous. And then I had another grandma called Grandma Alva. And Grandma Alva was the most boring human being who's ever walked the face of planet Earth. And I know that sounds cruel, but I totally mean it. As far as I knew, Grandma Alva only ever did one interesting thing. It was sometime in the 1980s. She came home and she was really upset. And she said, "I have just heard the most disgraceful song on the radio." She said they just kept saying over and over, "We'll go and get stuffed." It took us weeks to figure out she was talking about the song "When the Going Gets Tough." So I begged my parents to let me stay with Grandma Shirley while they were away. And when I was a kid, I had this obsession. I was always waiting for this stroke of good luck where my life would become extraordinary. You know, like in Spielberg movies, it always followed the same sort of template, didn't it? There'd be a weird, isolated kid, and then someone would come into that kid's life and turn it into an adventure. Or Marty McFly in Back to the Future. Marty McFly had nothing, and then he meets Doc Brown. And then suddenly he's got adventure, he's got time travel, he's got secrets, he's got flux capacitors. I knew that all I needed was some weird old man to take an interest in me and ask me to keep a bunch of secrets. When I was with Shirley, it felt like anything was possible. It really did. I didn't know it at the time, but that was because she was a fantasist. She was a dangerous fantasist. But to a kid, she just seemed fun. Like when I was a kid, I remember I said to her, "I wish I could fly." And she said, "Shh, don't tell anyone, I can." Then she came back a bit later and sort of qualified it. She said, "But I can't go very high." So I stayed with Grandma Shirley in that summer of 1988 when I was 12 years old. And one night, she asked me to keep a secret. It was the middle of the night. I was up wandering the house because I had trapped wind. So I'm up wandering around the house in agony. And my grandmother Shirley, she said, "I'll stay with you until the fart passes." Anyway, so we went and sat outside, right? It's a wise choice, really. It was a really hot Australian summer night, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. It looked spectacular. Only that day, the renowned physicist Richard Feynman had died. The man who had solved the mystery of why the Challenger space shuttle disintegrated 73 seconds into its flight 2 years previously in 1986. And I said the thing that I assume is the most said thing when people look at a stunning constellation. There's got to be life out there. And Grandma Shirley said, "Oh, there is." She said, "Can you keep a secret?" I was like, "Yes, yes, I can totally keep a secret. I am the best at keeping secrets." She said, "When I was about your age, I was taken." I said, "By who?" And she looked up at the stars and she said, "By them." Fast forward to 2012. I'm 36 years old and I'm pregnant with a boy. I'm visiting my grandma Shirley in the dementia unit of her new care home. I'm standing in the foyer One of the old ladies has a doll. She won't eat until she's fed the doll. A group of them are playing with Lego. I spot Grandma Shirley in the Lego group. She's building a spaceship. Feels like I'm in a parallel universe where there's been a glitch, and somewhere on another plane there's a toddler knitting a scarf watching Murder, She Wrote. I'm not looking forward to seeing Grandma Shirley. She was always so crazy and fun and beautifully groomed, but now the hair is nuts. I mean, she looks like Doc Brown in Back to the Future. She's been unravelling. She thinks that I'm her daughter, not her granddaughter, and at night time, she started worrying about getting home to make dinner for my grandfather, who's been dead for years. I just need a moment. So I go outside, and across the grounds of the home, I see a man building what appears to be a bus stop, but that can't be right. There are no buses here. And I stand there and I watch him building and painting, and he nods at me and I nod back. I'm stalling. So I go over and I say, hey. And he says, hey. And I say, this looks like a bus stop. And for a moment, I wonder if he's a patient. That actually happened to us. When we were first shown around the grounds of the home, it took us 10 minutes to figure out that we were being shown around by a patient. Who had previously owned a chain of hotels. And we only realised when he asked us if we wanted the continental breakfast. He's completely lost his footing in time and space. But this guy, the guy building the bus stop, he's too young to be a patient. And I ask him why he's building a bus stop. And he explains a thing called sundowners. Sundown is the moment to go home. It's getting dark. It's a signal that it's time to leave. The day's finished. And with dementia, that compulsion is still very powerful. At sundown, they start to panic because it's time to leave, it's time to go home, and they become agitated, distressed. So at sundown, they'll take them to the fake bus stop. They'll tell them, don't panic, you're going to go home. Just wait here for the bus. And then, with a smirk that seems brutal, this guy says, once the sun set, we'll just take them back inside. They'll have forgotten why they were so upset. And I notice that he keeps using the word them and they. Like they're not us, like they're a different species, like they're aliens. Now I'm starting not to like this guy. And then my phone pings in my pocket. Bing! My mum sends me a text message, entirely in capitals. She's had it on caps lock for months. But I also think it's the pitch of her thoughts. And the text message screams at me, have you seen the news? Whitney Houston is dead! And I wanted to text back, Whitney Houston, we have a problem. Feels a little insensitive. The emoji hasn't been invented yet, so there was no sad face. You know, it was up to me to decide whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. Back then, you weren't allowed to give people a hint as to how they were meant to interpret a statement. They had to figure it out on their own. And I say to the man painting the bus stop that no bus is ever going to stop at, hey, Whitney Houston's dead. And the man says, how do you know? I say, my mum told me. And he says, oh, does your mum know her? Then once again, I'm not sure if this guy's a patient or not. I say, no, I think mum saw it on the news. And the man shrugs and says, eh. And I say, don't you think it's just a bit sad? And the man doesn't care. He wanders off. He mutters something about not touching the paint, that they keep bloody touching the paint before it's dry. And there's that word again, they. And I think, no, we are they, I am they are us. We're all the same people. So on behalf of all of us, as soon as this prick is gone, I pick up a twig and I draw a dick in his fresh paint. And then we rewind, back to that summer in 1988. I'm 12 years old, I'm staying with Grandma Shirley. It's a hot summer night. She hasn't even got a trace of dementia. And she is telling me her alien abduction story. I was taken by them. Now, I'm a storyteller. Every compulsion for me was to change her story and fix it, but I haven't. This, to the best of my recollection, is the story that she told me that night when I was 12. So she reckons that she was playing on the front lawn at her parents' house. She was a little girl. And her uncle had just got back from Melbourne and he'd brought her a wooden toy dog. She's sitting on the front lawn. She's playing with the wooden toy dog. And then she said that she noticed that there was no sound. She said, when I looked up, it's like I was inside a photograph. She said that there was a car passing, the car was frozen, it was stopped, and the people in the car were mid-sentence, mid-blink. She looked across the street, she said there was a guy standing at a bus stop, he was hailing a bus, he was just stopped in time, just hailing a bus. She said, I was so frightened, I screamed out for my mum and I turned around and there she was, frozen. Then she said, it's like someone switched the sun off. Total darkness. And she said, when the lights came back, I was on some sort of spacecraft. I was like, then what happened? And she said, oh, darling, I can't remember, it was a long time ago. You'd remember that. She said, I don't know, they drove me around for a while. I said, did you talk to them? She said, nah, they didn't speak much English. And at the end of the story, she said to me, you do believe me, don't you? It was a horrible moment. At the beginning of that story, I couldn't believe my good luck. I mean, this was straight out of Spielberg. But by the end of the story, I was just old enough to recognise that my grandmother had a psychiatric disorder. But she had given me this moment that, for all of its flaws, it felt extraordinary. It felt remarkable. It felt like an adventure. And I said to her, of course I believe you. She said, I knew you would. She said, now you've got to promise me that you will never, ever tell a soul. Fast forward to 2015, the last time I saw Grandma Shirley. I visited her in the care home. She'd really gone downhill in the 3 years she'd been there. She didn't really talk much anymore. In the evening, Grandma Shirley and I went for a walk. She seemed tired, so we sat down at the fake bus stop. We sat there in silence. And I ran my finger along the paintwork until my finger stopped at a chipped depiction of a phallus. And suddenly, Grandma Shirley spoke. They're coming back for me soon, you know. And I said, who? And she said exactly what she'd said in 1988. She looked up at the sky, she looked at the stars, and she said, them. She died 2 days later. And when the nurses went into her room to answer the distress call, her body had gone. It totally hadn't. Oh, my God. Jesus. Your faces. Had she gone back to the spaceship? Oh, now I feel really bad. I'm sorry, I feel like, look, the only reason I end that story that way is because I just know Shirley would love that. She would love that as a story. I tell you what, I'm going to tell you the real ending to that story. This is the real ending to that story. Now, do you remember Grandma Alva, the boring one I told you about? Turns out she stabbed a guy. Let's rewind back to 1998. I'm 22 years old. My family and all four of my grandparents are sitting around the table. I've just got out of the pool. It's 36 degrees. It's Christmas Day in Australia. And it was a typical family gathering. My grandma Shirley is there. Her husband Spike is already drunk. He's complaining about immigrants. Grandma Alva is being pleasant and boring and vapid. Her husband, my grandfather Ken, he's fast asleep, but I think he's faking it. I think he's just closed his eyes. It's what he used to do when he'd had enough. He's been dead for a long time now, but I don't think of him as dead. My Uncle Christopher keeps singing, O come all ye faithful, but he's only singing the line, O come all ye faithful. And I feel really bad for my brother. He's 25 and his grandparents got him Lego. He has such bad luck with presents. He says no one ever gets him what he wants. His misery about his lousy present is only exacerbated by the sounds of pure joy floating over the fence from bloody Mike and Narelle's house. Bloody Mike and Narelle. Our obnoxious neighbours who Mum and Dad have had a begrudging friendship with since I was 3. Mike got Narelle a convertible sports car. Narelle got Mike a jet ski. And when Mum saw Mike's jet ski, she said, plenty of fun till you crash into a ferry. It's her latest cause of avoidable death. She'll move on to something else soon, like boxed jellyfish or falling coconuts. And everyone's chatting, everyone's drinking. My grandfather, Spike, he's telling the story he tells whenever he's had too much to drink about how he reckons that Clint Eastwood is Stan Laurel's son. My grandfather, Ken, has his eyes closed. He's eating what he thinks are grapes. And I look over at my grandma, Alva. She says, yes, yes, and no, no. And when she doesn't say yes or no, she says, I'm not sure. She decides to go outside with my Uncle Christopher. And while she's outside with Uncle Christopher, my dad tells a story. My grandma, Alva, was a young girl, and her family, they lived on a farm. It was during the Great Depression, and because work was so scarce, a lot of men took to the road. In Australia, we called them swagmen, and they'd go from farm to farm and offer themselves as labour. And apparently my grandma Alva used to love this non-stop stream of swaggies. She'd sneak them booze, she'd memorise their jokes, tell them to the next swaggies who arrived. She even got a belt across the back of the knees when her dad found her telling a joke that ended on the punchline, you push it to the side before you start eating. One evening, a swaggy who they'd helped out, he came back at night. He tried to steal some of their sheep. And Grandma Alva, who at the time of the incident was 12 years old, grabbed a carving knife, chased him across a field, and stabbed him in the back. And she didn't just stab him once. And that man was my grandfather, Ken. Listen, no, that doesn't even make any sense, guys. Your faces! Dad's telling this story. I can see Grandma Alva and Uncle Christopher through the fly screen. They're standing in silence next to the Christmas tree at the end of our garden, which at this moment in 1998 is around 12 feet tall. It's driving Mike and Narelle insane. They say it blocks out the light. Grandma Alva is putting sunscreen on Uncle Christopher. When Uncle Christopher was young, doctors thought he had brain damage until sometime in the mid-1950s when another diagnostic label came about. Severe autism. He's unreachable. He doesn't speak any language at all. The only language he has is the weird occasional line from A Christmas Carol. And I look at my grandma Alva, the most boring person on planet Earth. She's tending to Uncle Christopher. And I wonder where that stabby 12-year-old who liked dirty jokes went. I wonder what happened to her. Life is what happened to her. And I suddenly understand that she is far from being the most boring human on planet Earth. And then my mum calls everyone to the table. My entire family has gathered. Mum sets down an enormous leg of lamb. Grandma Alva picks up a carving knife. No one knows where to look. Suddenly we fast forward to 2018. It's my mum and dad's 50th wedding anniversary party. I'm 41 years old. I'm in my parents' new house, the house two doors down from where I grew up. My parents are now grandparents. My children and my brother's children are playing hide and seek in the bushes around the new Christmas tree that Mum planted in the new garden the second she moved in, just to annoy Mike and Narelle. And my friend Sally is at the party. She's 46 now. We were in a car crash together in 1980. She taught me to do cartwheels on the beach, told me about getting kissed on the ferry. I hadn't seen her since the party back in 2010 when the doctors told her she was in remission. Her hair's completely grown back now. She's still the most attractive woman in the room. I finish my beer and I do a cartwheel. My left foot wipes out a bowl of carrot sticks. Sally gives me a small round of applause as she heads inside. My brother Ben, he's there. He's 44 now. The only one in fancy dress. He's dressed as Borat. The people who bought our old house two doors down know my brother because whenever he's drunk, he goes into their garden. He goes back in time to the garden of his sixth birthday party in 1979, and he falls asleep under the old Christmas tree that now stands at 20 feet tall. About once a year, these new occupants find my brother in their garden, drunk, dressed as Darth Vader or Fonzie. Our first cat, Misty, was buried underneath that Christmas tree years and years ago. The only decent present my brother ever received will be forever buried under a Christmas tree. Grandma Alva, the very last remaining grandparent, now great-grandparent, she's at the party, she's 97, she's watching TV. And on TV, there's a program about the Challenger space shuttle, the space shuttle that disintegrated 73 seconds after takeoff back in 1986. And the program is about how one of the people on board was a teacher. She was meant to teach a lesson from space. And 32 years after that tragic day, two teachers are going up into outer space to teach the class that she never got to teach. And Grandma Alva watches this program with my son. He's 5. He's on the autism spectrum. He's obsessed with space, space rockets. He's sitting on Grandma Alva's lap, and she's playing with a cheese knife. Mum and Dad's neighbours, bloody Mike and Narelle, they nip around with a present. For Mum and Dad's 50th anniversary, Mike and Narelle have bought them a G-Tech hedge trimmer. With a 1.7 metre extendable reach attachment, lets you trim the top of trees that are blocking out people's light. Narelle insists Christmas tree needles are dangerous. She says the needles go in the pool, someone could step on one and get injured. And my mum says, oh, don't be so neurotic, Narelle! We're all assembled on the lawn, this cast of characters, all sharing this particular time on this particular planet. Even one of our oldest neighbours, Mrs. Drayton, even she's turned up. She's still got the hump because we stole her cat in 1979. My parents get up and they make a speech together. It's a very unlikely double act, like Laurel and Eastwood. Mum opens with a quick warning about a recent salmonella outbreak in bags of salad. Narelle tuts, you only get that in cheap supermarket brands of salad. But Mum's not finished. She follows up with some info about the human papillomavirus. See, for some people, the glass is half empty. For some, it's half full. For my mum, the glass is half empty and apparently filled with the human papillomavirus. And Mum's in the process of explaining how the virus is transmitted when Grandma Alva shouts out, you push it to one side and keep eating! My dad proceeds to tell a story to the gathering. It's about a morning back in February 1986 when we stood out on the front lawn together to see Halley's Comet. Me and my brother, we glanced at each other. We lied to him that morning. We said that we'd seen the comet. I can't believe my dad's telling this story at a wedding anniversary. I mean, this, in my memory, was one of the lowest points of their marriage. And my dad tells the room why Halley's Comet meant so much to him. He says Halley's Comet comes into the Earth's orbit around once every 75 years. Which also happens to be roughly the average human lifespan. So each time Halley's Comet comes back, there's a whole new set of people on Earth, a fresh audience, seeing it for the first time. But we're not really that different. We're all subject to the same forces of good luck and bad luck. And my mum cuts him off. Phil, people did not die 75 years ago from choking on Dr. Dre wireless earbuds. And Mike, who's still holding the hedge trimmer, says no, but they do die if they get a poisonous snake thrown at them. The speech has been completely derailed now. No one's listening. People are heckling each other. And then Narelle suddenly spews into a plant pot. She finds out the next day she's got salmonella. And finally, it's 2018, a couple of weeks after the anniversary party. And I'm back on the other side of planet Earth. I'm in my house in London. I'll be 42 soon. It's the middle of the night and it's really hot, so I go and sit in our tiny London backyard. My mum rings. My mum tells me that she's got some bad news. And I say, Mum, you always have bad news. But it turns out she does have bad news. She had spoken to Sally's mum earlier that day, and Sally's cancer is back. And it's in her kidneys. And I say to my mum, I could give her my kidney. That's a thing, right? People do that. She can have mine. And then my dad takes the phone. My dad, the biologist, the stargazer. And he tells me that it's too late and he's really sorry. And he asks me, what stars can I see? He always asks me that when I'm on the phone, it's nighttime. What stars can you see? And I look up at the sky and it's a classic London night. Smog. And I say to my dad, there are no stars tonight. And my dad says, there are. You just can't see them right now. It's always tomorrow. think of Haley's Comet sometimes when I can't sleep. I'm lying in bed, it's late at night. I close my eyes and I picture it. It's crunching through space right now. 70 kilometers per second. It's already more than halfway through its trajectory. It's going to be back here in a heartbeat. So I go inside and I switch on my computer and I write this short story. So if you want to know what it's like to be an astronaut, it's the greatest job in the world. I'm going to love being an astronaut till the day I die, which appears to be today. And for just a moment, I imagine that I'm standing on the ground and I'm with all the crowds and all of the TV cameras, and we're all watching the sky together. We're watching my space shuttle disintegrate. And I look at the clock on the dash and it says 73 seconds. I wish I could tell you that I thought about my family, thought about my kids, my parents, but I didn't. All I could think about was this grainy old photograph of Laika, the Russian space dog. She was launched into space in 1957. And the story goes that the Soviet scientists found this dog wandering the streets of Moscow, this mongrel who was impervious to cold and hunger, and she joined the space program. How's that for a classic rags-to-riches story? That's straight out of Spielberg, isn't it? Homeless dog, overnight, becomes world's first astronaut. Only thing is, it wasn't good luck, because they didn't have the technology to deorbit. So it was a one-way ticket. It was a death sentence. She died a couple of hours later from overheating. That was always just a detail of the story that I knew. But now I have a firmer, more fuller understanding of what that means. Now all I can hear is my breath, my pulse race. And for just a second, I swear I can feel Laika's heart beating in my chest. And in my last fraction of a second, I just see time folding over and inside itself, endlessly. And the same stories keep weaving through different faces over decades and centuries, millennia. I realize that me and a Russian space dog and the Chinese astronomer and William the Conqueror and a Babylonian scribe and that girl somewhere in time doing a cartwheel on a beach, a woman sobbing next to her car in the gutter, an old woman sitting at a bus stop lost in time, a hamster that just won't die. We are all the same thing. And it occurs to me that maybe there isn't good luck and maybe there isn't bad luck. Maybe we're just component parts of an endless story. It's always tomorrow. I wish I had just a few more seconds to enjoy this feeling and this moment. I realize it doesn't matter. Because somebody else will. It's the end of the world. It's the world. Australian Trilogy was written by Sarah Kendall and Carl Cooper. It was performed by Sarah Kendall, produced by Carl Cooper. It was a BBC Studios production. The mystery of life, the steps in the hall, the sound of the wind and the waterfall, and the riverbank sings.